Om Patram Karne Bishrinuyamatevaha Patram Pashe Mapshabirya Chatraha Stirairangai Istushtuvagum Sastanubihi Vyashema Devahitanyadayuhu Swastina Indra Vrittashravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swastina Staraksho Arishtanemihi Swastino Brahaspatir Tathatu Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. We're on verse 4, not 5. Om Agnirmurta, Om Agnirmurta, Chakshushi Chandra Suryao, Chakshushi Chandra Suryao, Tishav Shrotre, Tishav Shrotre, Vagvivritascha Vedaha, Vagvivritascha Vedaha, Vak vivratascha vedaha, vak vivratascha vedaha, vayuh pranaha, vayuh pranaha, hridayam vishwamasya, hridayam vishwamasya, padbhyam prativi, padbhyam prativi, yesha sarvabhutantaratma, Yesha Sarva Bhutan Taratma. Sandhi. Agnihi Murtha Chakshushi Chandra Suryao Dishaha Shrotre Vak Vivrataha Cha Vedaha Vayuhu Pranaha Hridayam Vishwam Asya Padbhyam Prithivi Hi Eshaha Sarva Bhuta Anta Atma Sarva Bhuta Anta Atma. In the verse 2, the Upanishad gives us a vision of Satyam and Mitya. It gives a vision of everything the Upanishad has to say. It gives a vision of the nature of the whole. And it gives a vision, and there's just two lines, one verse, so it's very terse, right? And then, having made this statement, this very terse statement, which tells you the nature of reality, it then goes on to expand, you know, in detail. And so Shankara makes a couple of statements about this I wanted to just tell before we really get into it. He says, and Swamiji, I mentioned it in his bhasha also, in the whole teaching tradition, the whole way of really learning just in India itself, but in the whole way of studying the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras, is to first present something in a very terse form. Right, so that you see the whole in two senses. You don't understand it, really. But there it is. What is going to be totally dilated, expanded, is given to you in a very brief aphorism. In fact, when you study the Brahma Sutras, you'll see the very brief aphorisms, like one would be, Atato Brahma Jignasa, Now, therefore, the desire to know Brahman. That's it. That's the statement. That's the aphorism. But then, word by word, that statement is unfolded. So that after it's been totally unfolded, when you go back to the aphorism, it's filled with all of this meaning. So you start with the whole, then you dilate it, expand it so that you see exactly what it means, and then you go back to the small aphorism. So here, the Mundaka makes a statement, because it's now starting to really unfold the nature of reality. And in this verse 2 is when it says, you know, the Purusha means the conscious being who is indwelling inside this body, one that you would take to be this body, that conscious being that seems to be dwelling in the body. This Purusha is Purnaha. From the word Purusha, it's Purnaha. Purna from the Pur. Purnaha means it's infinite. This one who's dwelling in the body is infinite. This body's not infinite. So that's making a little bit of a distinction there between the nature of this one dwelling in the body is Purnaha. The Shaya means the one who's indwelling. In the Puri also, the Puri means in the city. So the Purna stands for the Purusha, the Pur stands for Purna, infinite also stands for Puri, the one in the city, the one who's abiding in the city and dwelling in the body. This Purusha is Divyaha, consciousness, non-objectifiable, alaukika, that's which not objectifiable. It's amurtaha, it has no form. It's pure consciousness. It is amurtaha, it has no form. It is ajaha, unborn. It's talking about yourself, the conscious being, this conscious being. It's ajaha, it has never been born. It has no form. It's pure consciousness, divyaha. It exists inside and outside from the reference of the body, the self, that's indwelling. It's indwelling. Actually, it's inside and outside. In other words, it has no place because it's a murtaha. You can't place it, right? It's not like a little pea inside of your the pod of your body. It's a prana. So creative. It's a pranaha. This is the verse that actually was quoted in yesterday in the Atmabodha. A pranaha. It's a pranaha. It has no prana, no breath. A manaha. It has no mind. It's not thinking. It's not breathing. It's not thinking. Shubraha. It's absolutely pure. And it is akshara paritaha paraha. This is the key right here. And it is that which is beyond or more subtle than the maya, the akshara, which is called akshara, the maya that is responsible for the projection of the whole creation. It is more subtle than the maya, which is called akshara, and which is more subtle than this creation. The maya itself is more subtle than this creation because it is the one from whom the creation comes and resolves. But the truth of the maya, the self of the maya, is the purusha. It's a way to understand it. The self of the maya, the truth of the maya, the being of the maya, the akshara, is the purusha. The Purusha who is pure consciousness, who has no form, who is both external and internal. In other words, in reference to this maya, it's inside and outside. That means that there's no place where it is not. So what that means is that this Purusha, the one indwelling in the body, when I recognize that this Atma, right, is free from form. The Atma, the self, is free from form. This conscious being that I am, indwelling in the body, is free from form. And therefore, it has no birth, right? Because there's nothing to be born. It's not objectifiable. So it's changeless. And so this changeless self that I am, that I take to be in the body, is actually inside and outside. I'm not contained anywhere. And so there's nothing separate from me. So it is this self that is more subtle than the maya, which is responsible for this creation, right? And the maya itself, remember, normally Brahman, the self is called akshara, because akshara, the word means, right? The word means akshara, means that which never diminishes, that which never changes. It doesn't become greater, it doesn't become, it doesn't increase, and it doesn't decrease. It's changeless. That's what akshara means. So it doesn't go away, it doesn't diminish. So that's normally a word for the self, for Brahman, which is free from form. Maya is also called akshara, because the Maya also doesn't diminish. It is the Maya is what is bija or causal to the entire creation. So the creation itself projects from the Maya and resolves into the Maya. So the Maya is the causal condition, right, of the creation. And so the causal condition doesn't change. The causal condition holds everything in itself in unmanifest condition. But that causal condition, the Maya, which projects as this creation, what is its truth? What is its self? What is its being? And that is the Purusha, that is Brahman. So the self, the conscious being of the Maya is the Purusha. Okay, well, this is the verse. There, what more need be said? Okay, the whole vision is contained in the verse. But now, we have to understand this verse. We have to understand this verse from many different angles. So from this verse, we go into the verse 3, which we worked on last week, which says, Etasmat, from this Purusha, that is pure consciousness and changeless, right? From this Purusha, which is the self of the Maya. So this is, this little part is very important because this whole verse has to be carried forward. So it's from this Purusha, which is the self or the very being of the Maya, more subtle than the Maya, so the being, the self of the Maya. So it's from this Purusha that it says that the prana, the mind, the vital force, the prana, the manaha, the sarvendriyani, and all of the indriyas, the prana, the mind, all of the sense organs, and all of the sense organs and organs of action, it's from this Purusha, all of them are born. This Purusha with the Maya Upadhi, which has not innate to it, but which is the very being, the very truth of the Maya Upadhi. Okay? So it's from this Purusha with the Maya Upadhi that all of this is born. So it starts out with, and then it goes, Kam Vayu Jyoti Apa Prithivi Vishwasya Dharini. It says, from this Purusha, space, air, fire, water, earth, the earth which supports all things. From this Purusha, this universe on a subtle level is born. Because it says initially, from this are born prana, manaha, sarvendriyani, and the five elements. This is what we call Hiranyagarbha. So what they're talking about here is, how does the Maya manifest? The Maya, which is in causal condition, which can't be separated from Brahman, it's not apart from Brahman, it just has no being of its own, but it's not apart from Brahman. How does that Maya, Brahman, with this Maya, how does it manifest? Well, it first manifests in a subtle form, which we call Hiranyagarbha. And what is Hiranyagarbha? Well, Hiranyagarbha is the Maya manifest in the five subtle elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. And the components of the jiva, of the individual, that transmigrate. The subtle components of the individual that transmigrates. So what are the subtle components? They just list them here. The manas, right? The manas is made up of, we just say one, the mind. The mind is made up of what we call the ahankara, the I notion, right? The memory, the chitta, the buddhi, the intellect, and then just the fluctuating thought forms that hold the manas, which it's called manas, which actually holds the emotions. Okay? And so there's four. That's the manas, right? Then the prana. The prana are five. The pranas are what allows for the digestive system and the circulatory system, the ingoing and outgoing breath and the peristaltic movement. There's five aspects to the vital force. That's five. Then there's the karmendriyas, what allows this body, which indwelling in this body allows it to move. allows the hands to move, the feet to move, for speech, right? For sexuality, for evacuation, for waste evacuation. That's called the organs of action. And then there's the five sense organs. All of these, you know, five sense organs, that means the ears and the eyes and the sense of touch and the sense of taste and the sense of smell. These are 19 components. They're subtle. What do they mean by subtle? Is that when this body drops, this physical universe that we experience, right, is gross. Subtle means that which indwells the gross, which outlasts the gross, which is pervasive to the gross. That's what we mean by subtle. So when we talk about the jiva, the one who transmigrates, what are the components of that transmigrating jiva? It are these elements that are being talked about here, these 19 components. Four components of the mind, five sense organs, five organs of action, five pranas. It's 19 components. That's what takes body after body after body. But the point here is that in this verse, we're talking about Maya in its first expression in terms of the five subtle elements. Okay. So that's where it stopped. So Maya projects. So, but listen to the language. Etasmat jayate, from this Purusha, from this Brahman, this Hiranyagarbha is born. Right? Not from someone else. Right? So now, I want you to understand something here, what that means. If we say, the subtlety here. If we say, from this is born. What does that mean? It means that the this is causal to the that. Right? So from this is born. If I say, from the Purusha, the creation is born, the subtle creation is born, that means the subtle creation is not apart from the Purusha. Is not other than the Purusha. Okay. So there's going to be some things that we have to understand here about the relationship between the Purusha and the creation. So let's look at it first thing. From the Purusha, this creation is born, subtle creation. That means in the subtle creation, there is nothing which is not this Purusha. Right? So let me give you an example. If I take a lump of clay, and I say, from the clay, from this lump of clay, the pot is born. The pot is born. Is the pot really born? It's a very interesting relationship. From the lump of clay, the pot is born. Right? Well, the pot wasn't there before. Right? The pot was not there before. And the pot that is born, it is true, is nothing but the clay. And it is also true that the clay hasn't been born. Right? Do you see that? But all of this language works. We can say the pot is born from the clay. We can also say the clay has never been born. It's ajaha, right? We can still say the pot is born because the pot is useful. It's different than the lump. Right? Right? But in one sense, there is nothing happening. Because for what is actually there, nothing has actually happened to what is actually there. Right? Which is the clay. Right? The clay hasn't become anything other than clay. It remains as clay. But now this pot has come into being. Right? So now we have to account, going back to the Purusha, we have to account for this Maya, for this capacity, creative capacity, that allows the creation of duality, of change, of form, to come into being without the truth of it coming into being, because the truth of it is already the being which the thing that comes into being enjoys. See what I mean? The pot, the clay doesn't come into being. It is the being which the pot enjoys. So it can't come into being. It's already in being. So like that, the Purusha, you. You can't come into being. The Atma, Brahman. The self, which is just pure being, pure consciousness. It can't come into being because it already is the being. But there is a capacity which it has that we call Maya, that has no substance apart from it, that allows for the expression of this creation, which has no being apart from it. So now let's go back to our clay pot. The pot, the clay, doesn't come into being. Okay? What if, you have to imagine now why we even need Maya, because there's the any example we use in the creation is limited. So here's the limitation with the clay. We have a lump of clay. Everybody knows it's a lump. It's not going to turn into a pot by itself. Somebody has to come and make it into a pot. Okay? And so there's got to be a pot maker, something that causes that to come into a meaningful form. Something has to act on the clay to bring it into a meaningful form that we can call pot. And that's going to be something outside. So the pot maker is going to be different from the clay. And the pot maker is acting on the clay to produce the pot. And so we all know this, and all these other little, so all these additional little realities are taking place as we use the clay pot example. So here, in this situation, when the reality before the creation is just the Purusha, because it says, from this Purusha, this creation is born. Okay? That means this creation is not here before. Okay? So now, from this creation, from this Purusha, this creation is born. And what is this Purusha? Just pure being. The Purusha means me, the self. It's just pure consciousness. It has no form, and it is changeless. So we'll just back up for a minute. Yourself, right, the conscious being, can't have a form because yourself is the one that illumines all forms. Right? Say yourself had a form. Then what is the form of yourself when you're unhappy and then changing to sad? There's the clay, there's the pot going into a plate. Right? But there's someone there who's free of that, unattached to all of that. That's the one that is illumining and present to this set of forms, and now present to this set of forms, and now present to this set of forms. That one can't be a form, right? Nor can that one who's present to this form and this form and this form and this form, meaning this experience and this experience and this experience, or this perception and this perception, the one who's present to that cannot itself be the object, right? If it's the object separate, from the subject, I mean. It can't be the object that you're looking at, right? It can actually be the substrate being of the object, but it can't be the object that's being looked at in a subject-object relationship. That won't work, because then who's looking at that object? Who's illumining that object, right? And so this Purusha that you are, I'm saying this right now is because I want you to realize that we're talking about you, about the conscious being that you are. There's no possibility of you changing, because if you were changing, then what happened to the last set of experiences that you remember? In other words, there's somebody who's present, a conscious being who is present to all experiences. That consciousness is not changing, right? And so that consciousness is the Purusha, the Divyaha, the one who is beginningless. So that one is always the same. Now, we have this Dehatma Buddhi, we have this identification with the physical body that makes you think that this consciousness is abiding in the physical body. That's why in this verse it says, you know, it's internal and external. The consciousness that you are, that you've placed in this physical body, we say it's internal and external because this world that you perceive, all of your experience, whether it be internal or external, is not away from consciousness. Right? Because everything enjoys consciousness. Everything is known, whether it be a subtle thought in your mind or it be a perception. There's absolutely nothing that's away from consciousness. So, but it's only because from the standpoint of this physical body, you say this consciousness is the consciousness that I am is abiding inside of me, right? Because here I am looking out through my sense organs. So I say the consciousness, this changeless consciousness is inside of me. Because here I am looking out at all of you. But he says, no, it's not inside, it's inside and outside. Because actually, this one that is looking out at you is also being perceived. You're aware of your body, you're aware of your sense organs. So this one that is being perceiving in this creation, you're the seer and you're the seen. I'm the seer and this is the seen. This whole activity of perceiving and of thinking, all of that is also being illumined by consciousness. So it's all known. So there's no inside or out, inside or outside. All of it, in fact, is just in me, in consciousness. So what is the relationship of all of this? All of this to me? Well, the Shastra says it is born from me, me being not the body, mind, sense organs, all of which are part of the creation. It is born from the Purusha, the self. And how is it born? How is it born? How does it come from me? You know, how can it come from me? Because I don't change. I am unborn. So I can't become, I'm Purnaha. I'm infinite, I'm changeless, I'm pure consciousness, I'm Amurtaha. I have no form, right? Because I illumine all forms. If I illumine all forms, I can't have a form myself. So I illumine all forms. So how can all of this then come from me? That is exactly what the Maya Upadhi is. That is the nature of the Maya Upadhi. That's why we say, and it's brought, this akshara is brought here in this verse, we say that because of the Maya Upadhi, Brahman is called the Vivarta Upadana Karanam. The Vivarta Upadana Karanam. What that means is itself undergoing no change. It becomes the, it is the material cause, the very being of this creation. Myself undergoing no change, I am the very being of this creation. The very material cause of this creation. Then it also says, the Purusha is the Nimitta Upadana Karana. It's not only the Upadana Karanam, which means the material cause, like the clay is the material cause of the pot. It's the nimitta. That means it's the intelligent cause. It's also the pot maker. Right? That Brahman is the material cause, the clay of the pot, but also the pot maker. The nimitta upadana karanam. Example that's used kind of like a dancer. The dancer is the nimitta upadana karanam. The dancer is both the creator, the intelligent principle of the dance, and also the material cause of the dance. The dance is not away from the dancer. And the intelligence that's creating the dance is not away from the dancer. So in that way we can say nimitta, that's an example in the world of nimitta upadana karana, of the efficient material cause. So now we say, okay, this creation has my being as its material cause, and also as the creative cause. But the creative cause requires Maya. Right? That's where we bring in Maya. What is Maya, and where does Maya exist in relation to Brahman? So this whole arena now has to become understood, because if we say in Advaita, right, if we say in Advaita that there is only one self here, which is yourself, there is only one being here. There's one without a second. There is only one being here. Then what I have to understand is, how can one being become many and still be only one? How can that happen? What are the elements involved in that? For that to happen, there has to be one reality that we call Satyam. Right? That one reality that we call Satyam, one without a second. Satya means that which exists in all three periods of time, past, present, and future. It can never be negated. That's amurtaha, that's formless, that's changeless, it's unborn, it's consciousness. It can't be objectified. That one is, period. It is and never not is, it is. And that's the one without a second. This creation has to be that, or we have two. If there's anything in this creation that is not that, then we have the amurta, pure divya, the pure conscious purusha, and this. Then there's no Advaita. So the vision of the Upanishads is that this satyam is this. Period. This satyam is this. In the, you know, Purnamidah, Purnamidam, that we chant every evening, Purnamidah, Purnamidam, from that Purna, that infinite, this infinite. From that infinite, this infinite. Yeah. That infinite sustains this infinite, and this infinite goes back into that infinite. Okay. So now, what the Upanishads are unfolding, they're going to go into some depth here, is for you to see this, to recognize this creation that you experience as not being other than that. Let me put it more personally. For you to experience this creation as not being other than me. And then we have to, of course, understand who that me is, right? Because that me, this physical body, sense organs, mind, right? The I thought, I am doing this, I am doing that, all my knowledges and ignorances, all of the things that make me an individual different from you, right? All of these things belong to the creation. All of them are created. They exist within time and space. Everything that makes me different from you, or one object different from another, is part of the creation. Right? That's why in this verse 2, or in the, I'm sorry, verse 3, it's from this that the Upanishad starts right away. It's from this self with this Maya that the jiva, all of the elements of the transmigrating jiva are born, and all of the five subtle elements are born. So immediately, everything about you is included in the creation. Right? From that self, from the Atma, from the Purusha, that is changeless, that is pure consciousness, that is beginningless, that is unborn, from that self, all of the minds, right? From that self, all of the minds, all of the vital force, all of the sense organs, all of the organs of action, all of the five elements are born. Now we have the creation. Everything that you take to be your being is actually part of the whole creation of that which is born. You see what I'm saying? All of that which is born from what? The one conscious being, which is pure consciousness, which has no form, which is indivisible, which is changeless. So from that one self, all of this is born. All of this is born in what way? As this, from the one self, as the Vivarta Upadana Karanam, means my being, without going through any change, becomes all of this. the clay, not going through any change, becomes the pot. Clay remains pot. Clay remains clay. The rope, another example, and you have to kind of play these two examples against each other, just juxtapose them side by side. The rope, without undergoing any change, becomes the snake. When a rope appears as a snake, the rope, without undergoing any change at all, becomes the snake. This is a good example for understanding the relationship of Maya to the rope. Okay? So if we have the rope plus Maya, okay? Rope plus snake, we'll just play with this for a minute, because I want you to understand the reality of Maya. Okay? What if we think of rope, if a rope appears as a snake? Rope is the truth of the snake, right? It's the upadana karanam. It's the material cause of the snake. Everybody agree with that? Because the number of bends, the diameter, etc., of the projected snake is only the rope. So the rope is the satyam. That's the truth. That's the truth of the snake. What is the reality of the Maya, of the snake? Does it have any reality? It's an interesting question, because if I were to remove the rope, or if I were to even recognize the rope, the Maya goes away. Right? There is no snake, really. Just like there is no pot, really. There's only the rope. But the Maya is there, right? That allows for that projection. Let me give you another example of Maya, just so you can really understand what it is. When I ask you, just as, because what you have as a jiva, right? You are part of the Maya, right? You're part of the creation. If from the Purusha this creation is born, your body, mind, sense organs are part of that. So the elements of Maya, you are, right? You are the Purusha. But all of the elements of Maya are there for you also, because that's responsible for all of the names and forms. Okay, so now, that means that Bhagavan made this creation in such a way as to give you a little bit of Maya. You get to be the Mayavi. Sometimes Ishwara is called the Mayavi. It means Brahman plus Maya, this creative capacity. Brahman becomes the Mayavi, the one who wields the Maya, the infinite Maya. This creation, right? This creation comes from Brahman, but actually what is being wielded as though, or wielding itself, is that infinite creative material that we call Maya. Now this is the thing. Does this Maya have any substantial reality apart from you? That's the question. Who is the reality? Because think of it. If I ask you now to imagine a meadow, you can easily do that. You don't even need to shut your eyes. You can imagine a meadow. And everybody has their own little meadow. If we compare, we'd all have different meadows. So maybe you imagine a meadow. And you imagine yourself walking through the meadow. And you imagine the birds and etc. It can be a very vivid imagination. And then you can stop the imagination. And then you can have an imagination of the beach at sunset, walking along the sand. Yeah. You can change that imagination. That's Maya. That's very, very powerful. You can have an active imagination. If you're a Jungian, you can just go inside yourself deeply and just go into an imaginary world. You can have fantasies. You can have daydreams. You can have dreams at night. That is Maya. Right? You can mistake a rope for a snake. That's Maya. Right? That is a creative capacity that is so very powerful. Right? So we all have that capacity. Where it's not unknown to us. But now we have to analyze what is the reality of that capacity? Does it have a being of its own? Does it have a being of its own? You would say no. Because I can imagine a creation, and that creation, as long as it's there, and within itself it has its own laws and its own reality. But it's only there as long as it's there. I'm there the whole time. I'm the clay. I'm the one who is the being of the imagination. I am the truth of the imagination. I am the one from whom the imagination has come. I'm the self of the imagination, the substance of the imagination. There, I'm the rope of the snake. There is no part of the imagination that is in any way separate or other than me. So in reality, I can say, I am the whole. Say in reference to the imagination, I can say many things. I could say, I am the whole. I could say the imagination is born from me, is sustained by me, it resolves into me. I can say there is nothing here but me, right? Because if you can't say there's nothing here but me, then there has to be something else, and what is that? It's like the clay saying, well, I'm here, you know, but the pot's here too. No. The clay can say, think of the clay pot. The clay pot can say, you know, the pot is nothing but me. It can say, I am the pot. It can say, I alone am. Right? Because there's nothing there but clay, really. I alone am. I am. So it's all standpoints. See that? If I'm acknowledging there's a pot, I can say, if I acknowledge the pot, I can say, the pot has come from me, is sustained by me, and goes back into me. It could say, I am the truth of the pot. Because the pot has no being except for me. And the pot has no being other than me. And it could say, there is no pot. There's only me. So you have to be careful. You have to understand the standpoint. Because so say some teacher comes along and says, you know, universe, what universe? There's only me. And then you think, oh, my God. What about what's going to, when I become enlightened, then I also won't see a universe. But that's not what the teacher means. So we have to understand all of these levels. You can say, you have to imagine the clay being able to say, there's no pot here, there's just me. You know, they're saying to make a point, right? Because the same clay could say, you know, the pot is mitya. Mitya means it has no being apart from me. That's what mitya means. It has a dependent reality. It has an apparent. When we say, when people walk around saying, oh, the creation is illusory. It's an illusion. That doesn't ring right for people. That's unfortunate when that's said. But what's trying to be said there is this has no reality apart from the satyam, the truth. But then the problem is if you use a word like illusion, then we think of ourselves having an illusion. You know, something going on that is ephemeral. And that's not what's meant. There's nothing ephemeral going on. There's a creation that has for its being the clay, the one self, the one consciousness. And so, the task now, first of all, the Upanishads are trying to say, okay, this self, which is changeless, which is pure consciousness, which is the Purusha, means the self that you take to be your own being, which is your own being. It is this self, which is free from form, which is just the conscious me, the conscious self that you are. It is from this self that with the Maya, the akshara from the previous verse, that all of this has come. And all of this means what? Well, first of all, the five elements. Space, air, fire, water, earth. And then all of the indriyas, the organs of action, the sense organs, the mind, the prana. all of all of what makes an intelligent being, okay? All that makes an intelligent being. You with me on that? Okay, so now look at what they do. Now we'll go to the verse. Now they say, we have to continue. We carry over from the previous verse, etasmat jayate. From this purusha, jayate is born. So what is born? We're now going to look at what we call virat. Okay. And we're going to look at the physical creation in a poetic way. It's in a sense as though we're going to visualize it as an upasana. So we're going to visualize virat as an upasana. What virat means is the Hiranyagarbha, the subtle elements, go through a process to become this physical universe. The physical universe, all that we experience through our sense organs, is called virat. Okay? And so now they have something, a way for you to visualize virat as a conscious being. Okay? So let's look at how they say. The one for whom yasya is something is going to be carried throughout this. Agnihi, the fire. Agni means fire. But here, fire is referring to the heavens from a upasana, particular upasana where Agni, the fire, is equated to the heavens. So this is actually from an upasana. So the fire, which means the heavens, and you'll see that relationship carried throughout. The Agnihi Murta, the heavens are his head, Murta. So just imagine now, we're going to have like an upasana, a visualization of Ishwara. The heavens are the highest you can go. If you look at all, think of in the whole cosmology, there are many, many different planes of existence. The heaven, the Dyuloka, being the very highest. Okay. So imagine if we're going to see, we're going to put a form as though to Virat, to Ishwara, to the Lord. We're going to give a form to Ishwara, okay? A physical form to Ishwara. So now, here we are in this physical universe, the heavens above, okay? All of the lokas, all of the subtle elements, of all of the different levels of experience, all of the lokas, the heaven loka, the dew loka is the highest. Okay? So agnihi murta. So the heaven is his head. Chakshushi chandra surya. The moon and the sun are his eyes. Okay, so imagine that. Now, there's something beautiful about this, as you'll see as we proceed. You as a jiva, as an individual, you require the sun and the moon to see. Right? And so Ishwara, are the eyes of Ishwara, are those things that enable you as a jiva to see. Okay, so Ishwara's eyes are those functions in the universe that allow you to see. So that's the relationship between the individual and the total. So now imagine, his head is the heavens. His eyes are the sun and moon. Dishaha Shrotre, the four quarters, east, west, north, and south, space, represents space, are his ears. The sense of hearing is hearing and sound travel through space. Sound is considered to be a guna or an attribute of space in the whole cosmology. And so without space, you can't hear. Shrotra. So your ears won't function without space. So the Lord, the ears of the Lord are the space of Ishwara. The ears of Ishwara are the space because that's what allows you to hear. Vak is speech. Vivrataha Vedaha. The speech are the Vedas, which are well known. The Vedas are in India, so you remember this Upanishad comes from the Vedas. The Vedas are the revealed scriptures of India. So the Vedas are considered to be the Vak, the speech of the Lord, because they're revealed. This is what Ishwara has to say. These are the words of Ishwara. So the words of Ishwara are the Vedas, of which the Upanishads are a part. So his speech, they're the Vedas, which are Prasiddha. Everyone knows what they are. Okay? They don't need to be explained. Everybody knows. Okay, so well known, they have gone. Vivrataha means they have spread everywhere. Okay? So the words of the Vedas not only give self-knowledge, which tells what is the nature of this reality, so it explains itself, it also tells you what are the rules, what is the Dharma, how to take care of your needs as a jiva within the creation. So all the means and ends that are necessary for a human being, those are the words of Ishwara. The Upanishads, the Vedanta, the second last part of the Vedas, give knowledge of this creation for those people who become a mumukshu, for those who need to know, for those who need to get off this cycle of samsara, who need the liberation, the moksha. The words of Ishwara are in the form of the Upanishads to release all of those who are seeking liberation. The Karmakanda, the first part of the Vedas, those are all the ways of means for those who still feel or believe that they can become whole, become complete through the fulfillment of their desires. So as long as you believe that, the first part of the Vedas to teach you how to do that with relative shanti, with relative grace, and with relative peace, how to live in this universe properly so that you can be have a life that has relative peace. I say relative peace because as long as you're within the cycle of the creation, you're within the creation, you're going to be suffering from birth and death and not getting your way. And you know, that's just the nature of the beast. But there is a way to be in this creation in order to have the least amount of stress and the most amount of peace. And so the Vedas lays that out for the individual. And then when you realize, you decide, well, there's no possibility that this can really free me. You know, is there a way out of this cycle of samsara? Then there's the Upanishads. And the vision of the Upanishads is this. This is an Upanishad, which is meant to release you from that cycle through knowledge, through giving you knowledge. So here he says, the Vedas are the speech of the Lord. Vayuhu prana. The wind is the prana, right? The vital force is the in and outgoing breath. Without any vayu, without any air, you couldn't breathe. There'd be no prana. Okay? So, for Ishwara, Ishwara is the vayu, right? It's the air which you breathe. Okay? So you can see the relationship. It's really nice. Then he says, Hridyam Vishwamasya. This universe, the Antakarna, the mind of the Lord, is this universe. And then Shankara says something beautiful about that. Because remember, this is an upasana for you to really try to... It's a visualization. That's why I used this example a little bit earlier. When you have a thought, right? The thought belongs to the mind. That's why I used the example of a meadow. You have a thought of a meadow. That meadow belongs to the mind, right? The mind is required for it. And so the mind is really the maya. You have the thought of the meadow, and the meadow can go away, and you can have another thought. But the mind is required. When you go into deep sleep, there's no thought of a meadow, right? When you're in deep sleep, the mind is in its avyakta condition, the akshara. The mind is in unmanifest condition. When the maya is in unmanifest condition, in the akshara, remember from the second verse, when it's in the unmanifest condition, there is no universe. But the universe is in unmanifest condition. When your mind is in unmanifest condition, there is no perception, there's no thought, there's no meadow, there's no imagination, there's just the avyakta. Avyakta means unmanifest. Right? So, here, in this Upanishad, in this visualization, the hridya, the mind, Hridayam means heart, and heart is used for buddhi, for mind, which is interesting. You know, because in India, you know, the heart and the mind are not separate, you know. Even the thought, when I'm thinking, you put your hand on your heart, not I'm thinking, like that. For us, it's I'm feeling, I'm thinking. But in India, you know, it's the buddhi and the hridaya, the heart, are not separate like that. It's really a very beautiful concept. And so you think of this mind, the mind is the whole universe, the whole manifest creation. That is the mind. That is the mind of Virat. And we say Virat because we're including the entire creation, not just the subtle. Because from in the process of manifestation, the Hiranyagarbha, the subtle, comes, and then the physical through a process of grossification. But that process of grossification, so we go from the Hiranyagarbha to the Virat, still there is nothing but clay. Still there's nothing but Maya that has for itself, right, the Purusha, the consciousness. So like that, so he says, the Hridayam, Vishwam, the whole universe is the heart. Then he said, Padbhyam Prithivi. It's from his feet that there's this earth. So now imagine the earth as his feet, the heavens, right? The heavens as his head, the sun and the moon as his eyes, the Vedas as his voice, as his speech, the prana, the vayu, the wind as his prana, as his vital force, the universe as his mind, and this earth as his feet. Then he says, so there's the vision, but then he says, Esha Sarva Bhutantara Atma, and this Virat, is the self of all beings. This is a huge thing to say. Is the innermost self of all beings. It says, Sarva Bhuta, all beings. Sarva Bhutanta Atma, anta means inner. The self, which is inner, anta, of Sarva Bhuta. So first, they give a vision of this whole creation. And then, and call that, that's the Virat. And then it says, this Virat is the self of all beings. This is exactly what's being said here. Is that if we go back to the clay pot, the clay becomes the pot, right? And then the pot is the self of the clay. No, the clay becomes the pot. The clay becomes the pot. And then the clay is the self of the pot. Right? So we can say the pot, clay has become the pot, and then the clay is the self of the pot. This is so important. This is how you can say, I am the whole. Right? Because this has all come from me, from the self, from the Purusha, and I am the self of all of this. That's the truth of it. And so now, how do we understand this? Swamiji talks in his introduction, in his Mundaka, introduction to this verse, I think, or the one before. In this teaching methodology, how to see this? How to really understand it? To see it? It's not intellectual, you know. You need to understand it intellectually, but it's not like that. You need to intellectually understand what you are seeing, right? It's not having an intellectual understanding that you memorize or something like that, an intellectual concept. It's a recognition. It's a recognition of the reality that you're experiencing. And so the reality that you're experiencing, how to see, I am this. My being is the self of all of this. That includes my being is the self of all of this. That includes my body, my sense organs, my mind, which belongs to the creation. But this body, mind, sense organs, everything that makes me an individual, this is part of the creation, all of which I am the self of as the Atma. My individual mind is not the self. I can't say, well, you know, you're all born of me. Everything about this jiva is born of the one self also. Right? So when we say one self means yourself. There's only one I am here. When you say I am, you say I am, you say I am, you say I am. The I am that the mind is referring to is the one self from which all of this diversity has come. And so we are only one being here. I am you. You are me. From the standpoint of the Atma, from the standpoint of the truth, right? From the standpoint of what is actually here. So I am the very being that you are. But of course, from the standpoint of the names and forms, all of these names and forms are a projection of Maya. There's so much diversity here. But what is the stuff here? How to understand that all of this, how to not just understand, how to see that all of this is me. To actually see that. Because if they're not making it up, it has to, the words have to be, and they're not making it up. The words have to point to the experience that you're having that you need to recognize. That's what it is. How to recognize it. So as Swamiji was talking, you know, he said a few words about this whole teaching methodology. The first thing we have to do is recognize this purusha, that I, in fact, this innermost being that I am, this conscious being that I am, is in fact this purusha, means that this consciousness, the self, is not something that I can objectify. I can objectify the body. I can look at it through my sense organs. Right? It belongs to the creation. That's experiential. I know this body through my sense organs, just like I know you. Right? So this is an object. It belongs to the creation. I need to experience the reality of it, of that. That's real. I see this body through my sense organs. That's how you know about it. Through your sense of touch, through your sense of taste, through your sight, through your ears, that's how you know about this. Just like that's how you know about all of this. You know about your sense organs through your mind. Your mind tells you whether your eyes are working or not. If your mind isn't using your eyes, you're daydreaming, your eyes are useless. They're all sense organs are all sitting here, you're daydreaming, not doing anything. So your mind uses these eyes, then they function. So these eyes are objects. They belong to the creation. Your mind belongs to the creation. It's known to you, right? It comes and goes and thinks and feels. So all of these, this is how to realize this. How to realize it, to understand the experience you're having here. Normally, we just walk around as this body. I am me and everything else is it. It's not. That's how we walk around, right? And then it works. It works fine. until we realize how, in some ways, it doesn't work, you know. But that's how we walk around. So now what do we have to do? We have to realize, well, no, this is not quite correct. It's correct on one level. But on another level, this is not correct. On another level, in fact, this body enjoys the same objectivity as your bodies do. This body belongs to the creation also. This body is as much in my awareness as your body is. Right? These sense organs are as much in my awareness as your sense organs are. This mind is known to me also, just like your minds are known. These are all things that are actually part and parcel of the creation that are illumined by awareness. See what I mean? What happens here is, and I'm not making this up. This is just something for you to notice. These are words that are meant to just point out something for you to notice that, How can you not say it's true? You know, because how can you say, for instance, you have to say that, yes, I know you through my sense organs. That's how I perceive you. What else can you say unless we're, I don't know, still making something up. I don't, it's just an obvious thing. How can you say that this body also is an object of my sense organs? How can you say it isn't? Because it is. There's nothing, you have nothing to say about that. Can you say that your sense organs aren't known by your mind? Can you say it? No. Because you know, if you're, you know if you're deaf, you know if you can see, you know all of these things. That objectification is a real experience. It's just simply being pointed out to you. But there are repercussions. That leads to something. If I can point, if that's pointed out and you see it, then what happens? That this body belongs to the universe. That's what happens. The sense organs belong to the universe, the world of objects, things that can be objectified. Is your mind known to you or not? So you say, no. No, it's not. You say, no. I say, yes, it is. Okay, it is. What about the I thought when you say, I am thinking? I am. It's just a thought. Belongs to the mind. It's just simply a thought. All of these things that I've taken to be me are part of Ishvara. They're part of the creation. It doesn't mean that there aren't capacities, and in the relative world, empirical reality, we walk and talk and do all of these things. But I'm talking about what is the reality of yourself. The reality of yourself is you are the Purusha, the one that is not an object. You are the conscious being that is not an object, that is not a form, that is the very being from which all of this comes. So, well, how can that be? Well, look at it. Just in your experience right now, is there anything experientially, you can say there's a lot of things away from my body, but I'm not asking that. I'm asking, is there anything away from you, consciousness, the conscious being, anything? Anything in your experience right now that is away from conscious, the consciousness and being, existence, the consciousness which is being, in fact. Being and the consciousness are one and the same. Is there anything? You say, well, yeah, I mean, this is a foot from this, and 20, I didn't say body. Body, the body belongs to the creation. The sense organs belong to the creation. The mind belongs to the creation. All of these things are objectifiable. But in all of this experience that you're having right now, include your body and your mind and your sense organs and everything. And now say, in this experience, is there anything away from consciousness, from your experience of consciousness? Consciousness isn't an object. I'm not saying that. You can say, oh, look at the consciousness over there, or look at my being over there. That's not what I'm asking. Is there anything that's away from your being? The best way to understand, if it gets a little difficult because the Dehatma Buddhi, this identification of the body, is so much... best way to understand it is go back to the meadow. If you have a meadow, an imagination of a meadow, and say you go into the meadow and you're walking in it with your friends, right? And the birds are chirping and there's the sun, the wind is blowing, there's some beautiful trees and animals running around. All that activity is taking place in the meadow, right? The individual you're identified with is part and parcel of the meadow, as are your friends, right? As is the sun, as is the wind, as are the trees. There's nothing at all. The seer-seen relationships, like I'm talking to my friend, seeing my friend through my eyes, and my friend is seeing me through, you know, his eyes or her eyes. But all of that belongs to the meadow, belongs to the imagination, all of which is being held in my being. I am the being and the consciousness of that whole thing. Do you see that? And that is my experience. If you have a meadow and I'm talking to you like that, oh yes, yes. Yeah. If you sit and have that imagination, you can recognize your own presence as the very being of the imagination, can't you? If you have an imagination, you can recognize how it is your consciousness and your being. How is this different? I'm seriously asking, how is it different? How is your experience in this room different from the meadow. If you allow your body to be an object, your sense organs to be an object, your mind to be an object, how can you say that there's any experience here that is away from your being? And so that's just something to start. We're going to go a lot deeper in this. The Upanishad itself goes. Oh, it's beautiful, Upanishad. It will go. It's going to really sit in this. But this is kind of a, it's an exercise of seeing. Right? It's an exercise of seeing, of recognizing, of being able to see I am the whole, and how the Upanishad says I am the whole. So that's what it's going to be doing. So let's stop there and we'll work on it. Just take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Did you say that there is one big self of which we are all little selves?
No, I didn't.
You didn't say that.
I didn't say that. I said there's only one self. There's only one self, and then this creation, every being in this creation enjoys that one self. So all of the different individuals are part of the one Ishwara. It's kind of like all of the different waves in the ocean. Right, all the waves in the ocean. There are many oceans, many waves, and they all are held together by the one set of laws that keep it as one ocean. So all the waves are included in the ocean.
But like you are saying that there's one self, and myself is part of that self, and yourself is part of that self.
What I'm saying, well, I didn't finish my little story with the ocean. But the truth of the ocean is one water, right? So there's one water. So like that, there's one self, right? Which is the same self in all beings, like that.
So I experience a self, and you experience a self, and it's the same self.
That's right. And it's the same experience. It's not like the mind. This is a kind of tricky thing. It's not like our minds experience the self. The self is the conscious experience. It's its own experience. So there is only one self experience. There's only one me experience. And that one me illumines and is, superimposed on the entire creation. So from Ishwara's standpoint, that me is identified with the entire creation. And from the Jiva standpoint, that me, right, is identified with each individual mind that then takes these bodies. That's why he started, it's interesting that in the Upanishad, he started out with Hiranyagarbha, right, in the subtle, because that's the intelligent principle, the mind, right? And that total mind actually is there in Virat also. The whole creation is considered the mind of Ishwara. And it says it right here. This whole creation is the mind. So nice to see it in the Upanishads, because we say these things, but then when it's, you see it right there in the Upanishad, just couldn't be more clear.
So that sense of the me experience is the one me experience.
Yes, yeah. And I say me experience, right? It's kind of awkward language. But what I mean is, when you say, I am a conscious being, and the sense of self that you have, you make the mistake that saying this, that I am the body, but the self that you're referring to really isn't the body. If the body were to drop, you would still be there. If the mind were to drop, the sense organs were to drop, the self that you were referring to as yourself, that you think is the body, that would still be there. You know, and that self is only one. Yes.
So the mind can't have an experience of the self. So the self is its own experience.
Well, you have to understand this.
Yeah.
How can the mind have an experience of the self when the self... Mm. It's like, how can the pot have an experience of the clay? Because it's the clay that is the pot's experience.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a subtle point, but it's so important. Did you understand? If you say the pot, and this is where meditation and everything gets, everybody gets so screwed up around this. The pot, let the pot meditate, and so it can have an experience of the self. But now I ask, whose experience of the self is it? Whose experience of the clay is that? I mean, the experience of the self is the experience of the self.
But the mind can recognize the self, make that...
Okay.
The mind making a differentiation, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. But don't think of it as the mind is here looking upon a self that is away from it. Mm-hmm. It's recognizing, the mind itself is recognizing that all of the thoughts and the changing moods and the changing emotions have a changeless being. And so the mind, which is the great labeler, you know, is able to now properly label the experience. Right? But even though it's differentiating and labeling the experience, it's not labeling something that is other than itself. Right? It's labeling, it's other than itself in the sense that it's satyam and the mind is mithya. So the mithya means that which is totally like the pot is mithya, the clay is satyam. Right? And so the mind is mithya. The self is satyam. What is the relationship between the mithya and the satyam?
Right? But does the mind see that? Does the mind see, well, my thoughts are mithya, but they're being
satyam. Yes. Because that's the experience. That's the experience. Because now let's go through this again. If you can, in a different, little different way, if you can say, I am my mind, which is normal for people to think, they might not walk in.
No, I'm not my mind.
You might not walk, but you know, actually, you probably don't walk around saying, well, I am my mind. We don't say walk around. We don't even walk around saying, I am my body. But we do walk around saying, I am old or young, or I am thin or fat, or I'm, you know. And with a mind, you don't say, maybe I am my mind. You say, I'm agitated, or I'm happy, or I'm dull today, or whatever. Right, so there's an identification with, I am my mind. So I'll just say it like that. Now, if you can say that, then the mind is not away from the self. Because the self and the mind, that's the clay of the pot. The thing that needs to be understood, so there's no distance at all, right, between the clay and the pot, is there? Yeah. Now, there's no distance between the mind and the self. That's why you can say, the mind can say, I am the self, or I am my mind. But the I, so when you say this, I am my mind, what is happening there? The I am my mind is another thought, born of ignorance. Okay. It is taking the I am, these two words, that are labeling you, which really is the Purusha, the changeless being that you are. It's labeling that, which is the very clay of the pot of the mind. Okay. And then lassoing it to itself, which goes on changing and coming and going, is very mithya.
Well, it's just a small mistake.
It's mixing the sati element here.
That's right. That's the whole problem. That's the whole problem.
But so, because sometimes when we talked about separating it out, then it does in some sense sound as if the self is over here and Mithya is over here. And
well, when we say separating it out, that's what Swamiji was talking about in this thing. When that's when I was trying to swing around. But yeah, we have to be careful. But when you do the seer-seeing differentiation, you are initially separating out the seer from the seen. You know, so here's the conscious being, you know, the knower, and here's the object known. You need to do that initially, right, in order to be able to differentiate the changeless. But then you have to show that these things that have been differentiated are mitya, that they have no being apart from what you've differentiated them from. Because otherwise, you've got yourself and these differentiated things. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
It's not me.
So these teachings and teaching methodology are speaking directly to pure awareness?
No.
And or using the mind to go through the mind.
No, I've got you. I'm clear on what you're saying. The problem here is not the awareness has no problem. You know, the awareness is the reality of yourself. It has no problem. The one that has the problem is the mind, right? That because of self-ignorance, which is beginningless, really, if you imagine the creation coming like a dream, the dream characters aren't in a condition, just in the nature of the dream, right, to have self-knowledge. They'll just automatically identify themselves with the body, mind, sense organs. So they need to be, a means of knowledge has to come along and make them understand, oh, well, actually, I'm the whole dream and I'm the self, etc. So here, your mind, even though the truth of the mind is changeless and really the self of the whole, that mind needs a means of knowledge for it to recognize that. And if it doesn't recognize it, then your mind takes itself to be the awareful being. And then you, the mind said, then you become finite and subject to change. And whatever the mind is, if the mind is happy, I'm happy. If the mind is sad, I'm sad. You know, if my body's sick, I'm going, or ill, I'm ill. If the body's going to die, I'm going to die. So we become, this all becomes the reality, you know. And this reality is subject to birth and death and change. And so therefore, I am subject to birth and death and change. You see?
Yeah.
And so this teaching is meant to make your mind recognize the truth of itself. Because it's in error right now.
Yeah. Even the question.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
But it's a perfect question. But you're right. The question shows that.
Yeah.
The question what?
Her question shows that.
I sense that. And so then the path, let's say, of bhakti or the heart, is that a different methodology to get to the same place? Or is that included in this?
It's included. In fact, from the book of Advaita, in fact, in some kind of neo-Vedanta, which is not really accepted and traditional, some people say there's jnana yoga, the path of knowledge, the path of bhakti, the path of karma. We don't accept that at all. In the Bhagavad Gita, the jnanam and bhakti and karma are all talked about as being just different aspects of understanding this knowledge. You know,
great.
Yeah, they're all one thing, but being viewed from different perspectives.
Okay, right. In the end, the mitya and the satyam are reconciled. It's like you see the satyam in the mitya. I mean, despite the mitya, you see the satyam.
Well, just like you see the clay in the pot, right?
Right. Yeah.
Like that, you see when you're experiencing the world, experiencing your mind, experiencing your emotions, the satyam and the mitya are self-evident. This is the difference, and why we can kind of get confused even in those words. If I'm looking at a clay pot, I'm seeing the pot, and I'm seeing the clay, right? Here, I'm seeing the creation, and I'm being the self. I'm not seeing the self. Consciousness is not an object to be seen, but it's the very being that I am, the non-objectifiable being that nothing is away from. And so I can't, if I use the clay pot example, that's so good to be able to see satyam and mitya, right? But from your, this illustration can become confusing because you're seeing through your eyes, there's a subject-object, you're looking at the clay and you're looking at the pot. You get me?
Yeah.
And then I'm saying, look, the clay is the satyam and the pot is the mitya. Now here, in terms of this reality, here I am sitting here. How am I going to recognize the satyam and the mitya? So now I'm going to start, well, now let me see. Let me see this the satyam here. No. You are the satyam. Your being, consciousness itself is the satyam. It's not an object. However, conscious being is not an object. However, there is nothing, nothing that's away from it. Even that's why if I use these examples, if I say it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, everything is, there's nothing away from being. But being itself is not something you're looking at.